From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's not for everyone the life of an historical reenactor. In fact, it takes a certain type to do it, to dress in authentic period garb and role-play a moment in history. But let's say you're thinking about it. The writer and actor Charlie Schroeder has some basic advice. Get in shape and stay hydrated. He knows this because he spent the better part of a year going from battle to battle as a reenactor. He was a Roman centurion in Arkansas, a German war correspondent in Colorado. He's been attacked by people in costume who are pretending to be British and French and Russian. He did it because he wanted to learn why people did it, why they gave up their weekends and spent thousands on period long coats and muzzle loaders. But he also did it to get a better grasp of history, to see what dressing up and marching for miles would tell him about the past. Charlie Schroeder will join us today. His book is called Man of War, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer and actor Charlie Schroeder to talk about the book that he's written about historical reenactors. These are the people who put on clothing and use the gear that's authentic to a particular period, and they stage these battles all around the country. Schroeder spent more than a year as a reenactor. He was a Nazi, a Roman centurion. He played parts in many of the big wars, colonial, civil, Viking, Vietnam. Basically, he wanted to know why these people, most of them civilians, would give up their weekends and modern comforts to experience war. The book is called Man of War, My Adventures in the World of Historical Reenactment. And Charlie Schroeder is joining us to talk about it. We invite you to join us as well. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Charlie Schroeder is a writer, radio producer, and actor, as I mentioned. His stories have been featured on NPR programs like Only a Game, On the Media, and some others. Man of War is his first book. He's joining us today from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. And Charlie Schroeder, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
I wanted to start with a story you tell in the book. You were writing about this experience of helping your wife, Wendy, cram for this test that she was taking to be an American citizen. And you're flipping through the booklet about the questions that they're asking your wife. And it seems like it was a really eye-opening experience for you in terms of what you actually knew, about this country that you lived in.
Yeah, nothing, I believe.
Right.
let's just say zero.
Yeah.
She is from Hong Kong, and she was studying to become a naturalized United States citizen.
Right.
And so they give out this, booklet of questions, and there are 100 questions, and I think they ask you 10 of them in this actual test, and I think you only have to get 6 right to become a U.S. citizen, which I love. You have to be a D student.
Right.
To become an American. Well, but of course, when I was reading through it, I was not even a D student.
Yeah.
I couldn't answer any of the questions. And it really dawned on me that I think when you grow up in a place, you just sort of take it for granted. And maybe you believe the myths of, your founding fathers and all this other stuff. And I was really struck by how little I actually knew, about American history. Mm. And that wasn't what put me on this quest, but it was certainly one of the things that motivated me to learn more about not just, American history, but history.
Yeah. Well, you write about how you grew up surrounded by history. You grew up in this incredibly old house. You had Amish neighbors who lived,
pre-industrial revolution.
Right. Exactly. Went to this really old school. I mean, you were surrounded by it. But
yeah.
But I guess, what do you figure you're typical of most of us? We may be surrounded by it, but we don't really know anything about it in depth.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I would say that I'm atypical in that I grew up in a log cabin that was built in 1740.
Right.
I don't think there are too many people. I mean, it wasn't even one of those things that really dawned on me until I moved out to Los Angeles, and I would tell people where I'm from, like, where are you from? I said, well, I'm from this small little village, in Pennsylvania, and I grew up in a log cabin that was built in the middle of the 18th century, and my neighbors were Amish. And as this was coming out of my mouth and their jaws were dropping, I sort of realized how unique my upbringing really was. Mm. I just took it for granted, and those were the Amish people, and they spoke old German that even Germans today can't even understand. And So it wasn't really until I got away from that that I realized how important it was in my life, because I no longer had that foundation. And I think we're all like that. I think that America, being the melting pot that it is, being such a new country, you know, it's often hard for people to identify with the historical events in our own history because we're still, well, we're still kind of developing, you know, and a lot of the issues that, you know, triggered the Civil War and, you know, were talked about in the Civil War are still issues that we're dealing with today in terms of the size of government and all this other stuff.
So you were typical of most Americans in the sense that before you embarked on this project, you knew a little bit about, I mean, you'd heard about, you know, Civil War reenactors probably and Revolutionary War reenactors. But then you and your wife go to this fundraiser. And it seems like this is when it really dawns on you that, wow, this is really quite a subculture, I guess.
It's huge. Yeah, it's big. It's broad. And that's the, I guess, maybe huge isn't the right word, but it's broad, that it spans a great length of time. Certainly the Civil War is the most popular war to reenact. It's about 50,000 Americans reenact the Civil War. But yeah, I knew that people did the Revolutionary War. I knew that there were Renaissance fairs where people dressed up as Elizabethans, but I had no idea that there were Romans and Vikings and Polish winged hussars out there. And so for me, seeing this, there was a parade. There was this fundraiser at a local fort near Los Angeles. And seeing this parade of these reenactors file by in chronological order, I was like just struck by the fact that not only do they go, you know, as far back as ancient times, but as recently as Vietnam. Mm. And so I kind of pictured myself embedding with all those different groups, not just to learn about the subculture of reenacting, but also about history itself.
What was it about the time? Because you write that it seemed like at the time the country was going through, and I guess in some ways it probably still is, but, you know, kind of that midlife crisis you talk about. There was all this political discontent. Of course, the Tea Party movement is kind of emerging. What did that have to do with the way you were thinking about this project?
Well, I think it's an interesting moment in time in our country because I think when things go bad, we tend to start to point the fingers and we start to say, well, this is the reason why we've gotten into the situation. And of course, people on different sides of the political spectrum have different opinions about why that's the case.
Yeah.
And so what interested me was that people were sort of using, in particular, like the Revolutionary War, you would see Tea Party members with the tricorns and they would go out in front of Capitol Hill and protest. And I think in many ways what they were trying to say is that, look, we are actually standing for what our founding fathers stood for. Mm. And that's a very simplified view of our founding fathers and of the current situation. I mean, it's not 1776, for example, and the founding fathers did not always get along very well. So for me, it was kind of, well, what did our founding fathers really believe in? And like you had mentioned earlier, I wasn't all that aware of really the complexities, because I think one of the things about any culture really is, you know, you put your founding fathers or you put the figureheads on money. You see them every day when you pull out your wallet. You pledge allegiance to them. You create myths about cherry trees and not telling lies and all this other stuff. And in a sense, we're all kind of, well, brainwashed to a degree to think that these are perfect individuals. And once you start to dig deeper, you realize, well, no, they're human beings just like we are, and they're capable of great, wonderful, and terrible things, you know. And I wanted to get to the sort of the heart of why, you know, people wanted to inhabit characters from the past. Why were they different than we are? Did they somehow represent something that we didn't quite manage to achieve, et cetera?
Several years earlier, I mean, you write about the time you worked as an actor, as a matter of fact, in a Renaissance fair. What did you think of them then? It seems like you kind of thought they were, you were kind of bemused by them, it seems like, at the time, I guess.
I'm going to use the word snarky. I'm going to say that I was a, snarky 20-something who, you know, here's the thing that's what's really, what interested me about people that came to the Renaissance Fair dressed in costume or dressed in uniform was that I was getting paid to do it. And this was the first time that I'd ever seen people who wanted to voluntarily dress up. And that was very peculiar to me. I didn't understand what the attraction was. Like, why dress up in really warm, uncomfortable clothing on a day when it's 100 degrees and the humidity is through the roof.
Yeah.
And so I didn't understand what it was. I didn't understand the appeal. And so, yes, at that time, I was very flip and I didn't have a very good frame of mind about it. But as time went on, when I left my Renaissance Fair gig, it stayed with me.
Yeah.
And that question really lingered. And I just wanted to know what it was. Why do people not only dress up or want to live in the past, but why are they attracted to a particular moment in time? Why are some people more attracted to ancient Rome and some people are attracted to the French and Indian War? Like, why do people do this? And so that was really one of the things that just stuck with me over the years. It festered, really.
Yeah. Well, I want to get to those questions because I think they're important, what you think you may have learned about these people. But it seems like, the book is funny, but it's not snarky. And you write with a kind of genuine affection for these people, but it would have been easy to make fun of them. I have to say, it could have been, you could have taken some cheap shots, but you know what I mean? So how did you sort of figure out how do you really tell the story? Because there are some people who are odd, kind of funny. So how did you strike that balance?
Well, that's a good question, and that's a question that a lot of people asked me along the way. In fact, a lot of people who aren't reenactors said, well, what's your angle? You're just going to make fun of them? Yeah. And I thought, well, no. First of all, I'd be the biggest jerk on the face of the earth. These people invited me into their lives. They let me wear their loner gear. They let me play along. I would be the worst human being on the planet if that was my intention. What I figured was, if I just present what happened, and obviously there's editing and writing and all that other stuff, but if I just present what happened, then people can make up their own minds.
Right.
You know, this is their hobby. Nobody's really, there are some gigs here and there that people pick up as extra work and what have you, but nobody's getting paid to do this. They're spending a lot of time and money and effort and love and care. And if I present how it is, people will say, well, I think that's really interesting. I want to join, or I think that's funny and odd. And it's kind of a curious subculture or whatever. But if I just present the material because the material itself is really interesting, then I feel like, well, I'll let the reader make up his or her own mind about what they think of the hobby. I mean, if I had made fun of anybody, hopefully, in the course of the writing, it was myself, because I really went from let's be honest, a pretty pathetic human being to somebody who's much more enlightened now about the past.
Yeah. And soft. You were soft. I mean, which sort of gets us to this first experience you have, where you're reenacting the Battle of Stalingrad in Colorado, and it's really cold. And this first experience, you're pretty miserable. And let's just say this right off the bat. You ditch out. You don't really...
I went AWOL in a fake war.
You went AWOL, exactly. Talk about that first experience that you have, because this was your first, real moment of getting in here.
I believe one of the reviewers said that he really chose a doozy for his first one.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was, after going to this fundraiser, which we spoke about earlier, where I saw all these different reenactors, I went home and I Googled Nazi reenactment because there weren't any, Germans or Nazis represented at this event that I saw, because I was, that's one group that's clearly not there. And I found this event and I ended up emailing the people and they were like, sure, come on. And we were 60 miles east of Colorado Springs and we were reenacting the Battle of Stalingrad, which is truly one of history's worst events ever.
Yeah.
It's like, why would you want to choose to do this on your weekend? And, but the event itself really only lasted for 48 hours, or maybe even like 36. And the temperature dropped to 20 degrees. I had not prepared at all, of course. I was 37 at the time. I hadn't been to the gym in, 5 years. And here I am lugging all this gear on top of me, 20 pounds of gear. And it's thin leather straps. This is, this is not a cushioned pad that we have like our backpacks these days. Forced march of 6 miles. And I really lost... I was like literally starting to lose my mind. And I, we were supposed to spend the night in an abandoned one-room schoolhouse. And then we were going to launch a surprise attack on the Russians at 3 a.m.
Right.
And I remember thinking, I just want to see my wife. Mm. I just want my pillow. This war is heck. And, I fled. And it was, I think when I walked away from that experience, ironically, having dressed up as this German, you know, I had a swastika on my, you know, jacket, my tunic and everything. I was like freaking out. But the thing that ironically that I took away from it was such a huge appreciation for what the men and women of our military go through.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't handle a fake war for 9 hours, let alone you think about all the people who were deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan and who've been redeployed over the years. And that was something that has stayed with me forever. And if there's one thing that I took away from this experience that really hit home was that,
You know, the thing that comes up in that story, of course, is the obvious one about why would anyone want to be a Nazi? You know, why would they want that role? And that, I guess in some ways it seems a little creepy. And you do question people. It seems like, not you in the book necessarily, although, but you would naturally question the motives of people who would want to wear uniforms that had swastikas on them.
Yeah. And I think that there are a lot of complex reasons why. I think there's some simple reasons why is that people like to play the bad guy.
Yeah.
I think that that's one of the things where there's a romanticism involved with dressing up as a Nazi. I write about in the book when I was 18 years old, I considered hanging a swastika flag.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, this was how naive I was because I didn't put two and two together. I grew up in a part of the country where I didn't have any Jewish friends. I had like maybe one friend of color, a very white, you know, Anglo-Saxon Protestant part of the country. And I think that there's ignorance involved with it. And I think that there is a fascination with the military tactics, certainly them with their power in World War II. But also, and one of the things that many of them tried to deny throughout the course of our correspondence with any sort of affinity or allegiance towards the Nazi parties, it's one of the guys said, well, you know, some of them wear the swastika a little too close to their heart.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of stuff going on in different forms. I'm not saying that every reenactor is like this at all. I'm not saying this. But I think a lot of people probably have jobs where they're not in the type of power position that they necessarily would like. And one of the guys says, you know, they play they're a security guard during the week, and on the weekend they get to play general field marshal.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's this power play, right? It's an empowerment thing. And I think if you go out and you can play the field general in the war and you're one of the strongest, most important military leaders, then there's some sort of satisfaction in playing that.
You write about Dan Armstrong's one of the he's the guy that came and picked you up at the airport from Colorado. And, you know, you're talking to him about this. And he gives you a sense, I guess, and you do in the book about, I guess, the type. What's the type? And you write about, you know, most are military collectors or military buffs. That seems to be part of the type. It seems like most of them own guns.
Yes.
Most of them are pretty conservative politically. I mean, you heard a lot of political rhetoric going through all of this.
I mean, I would say it depends on the era.
Yeah.
And it depends on the region of the country.
Right.
For example, Rome. Okay. Just to sidetrack off of, because I think the more modern wars, I think when you get into the 20th century, likely they're more conservative. But I think when you
why? Because they're connecting to a more modern time?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think because of the weaponry,
yeah.
I think there's an attraction to that as well. Mm-hmm. It's particularly, this is, you know, one of the things that somebody said to me, a reenactor said to me was, in particular with Vietnam, reenacting Vietnam, was that reenacting Vietnam isn't history, it's a reality.
Right.
And I think that there is something about using the modern weapons, dressing up in, you know, using loud weapons, that is attractive to people who are more probably conservative.
Right.
I think that the farther back in time, like, for example, the Vikings, there aren't guns. There are fake swords or there are, you know, bows and arrows. And I found, for example, like with the Vikings who I hung out with, that some of them were doing it because the Vikings were, they empowered women. Mm. And women had strong leadership roles. And so there was a different type of person attracted to that moment in time. And so I think that it's often reflective of who you are now as to why you want to reenact a particular time period. For example, in Rome, people in the South tend to want to reenact Rome more because of the biblical leanings or their biblical beliefs. Whereas here in Southern California, I ran across a professor of religious studies who's quite liberal and another antique coin dealer. And they're attracted more to it as, you know, their culture. Mm-hmm. So depending on where you are in the country, depending on what your beliefs are today, I think that's what pulls you into a certain moment in time as well.
Charlie Schroeder is with us. His book is called Man of War, My Adventures in the World of Historical Reenactment. You can join us if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment, you're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Charlie Schroeder is with us. We're talking about his book, Man of War, My Adventures in the World of Historical Reenactment. You can join us, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So there's this term that you use fairly early in the book as you're discovering how this world of historical reenactment works. It's called, you would hear this term from time to time, period rush.
Yes.
I wanted you to sort of describe it. It's this sense of, like, man, I'm really there. It was kind of like a buzz that you would feel almost, I guess.
You'd been transported through time. You actually were able to pass through the space-time continuum and time travel. Yeah. And for a lot of people, that's one of the thrills of reenacting. And it typically happens, I would say, when you're at what I call a private reenactment, and these are reenactments that take place on private property. There's no paying public. It's not a fundraiser for a local fort or anything like that. And you do have to pinch yourself now and then to remind yourself of where you are. And it doesn't really take long. I know it sounds kind of strange to say that. Oh, well, how could you ever really travel through time or think that you've, you know, landed in AD 43 or anything like that? But it really doesn't. I'm reminded of there was a Stanford experiment where students and were divided in between prisoners and guards. And I think after like 3 days, if I'm getting my facts correct, the guards started like abusing the prisoners, quote unquote, you know. And they were just put in the situation. They were put in this prison situation. And this is what happened. It took them 3 days basically to go from students to really living out this situation. And so, especially with historical reenactment, where you're in a private setting, if you're in a setting where you don't see any modern houses or telephone poles or anything like that, it doesn't take long to try to, you know, feel as though you've had this period rush, that you are really there. And at times, I kind of found it to be slightly disturbing.
Yeah.
And at other times, I found it to be exhilarating and strange, you know.
Mm.
Hard to recover from at times.
Yeah. One thing that's interesting is it kind of, at least initially, the Stalingrad reenactment. You write about the page of rules that were there. And one of them was so intriguing. It said this. You write this. Remember, reenact for the guy on the other side of the front line. Give him a good show and he will return the favor.
Yeah. You know, that's a great line that they listed on their that was one of the rules on their website. And for me, that took a long time to understand. You go to these places, and obviously, again, there was no public there. There was no paying audience. And I had started off as an actor, and I knew the rules of the game as an actor, right? You dress up, you know, you put on different clothing, you go out on stage, you read a script, there's an audience there, you entertain them. At the end of 2 hours, it's over, they applaud, you go home, you put your clothes back on. Now, when I'm doing this, I'm like, well, who's the audience when it's just us? And it took me a really long time to comprehend the appeal and what the intent was. And what it was is that we are not just the participants, but we're also the audience.
Yeah.
And so it's this experiential piece of learning, really, about, well, you want to know what it's like. You've done all this research, or maybe some people haven't done research. It all depends on the individual, of course. Mm-hmm. But you want to, you know, you remember all the stuff you read about Stalingrad? Well, here it is.
Right.
And the more you take it seriously, the more that guy on the other side is going to take it seriously. And if we all take it seriously, then you're going to have your period rush. You're going to have this experience, and you're going to have your mind blown. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the intent with a lot of this.
Do most people play along? I mean, I guess why would you do this if you wouldn't? But are most people, you know, putting on the show?
Well, you know, what's strange is that people sort of half do it in most. I would say that most people half do it. And by that, I mean, like, nobody's really in first person, yeah. I guess. There were moments when I saw that where people would sort of take on roles. But by and large, you know, when I went into this, I was Charlie. The authenticity aspect of it, that portion, was really the preparation more than anything. It was making sure the uniform was correct. It was making sure that all of the weaponry was accurate. It was making sure that the choice of topography or whatever piece of property that you did it on was correct. But then once you were there, it wasn't like people were improvising for, you know, 24 hours or 48 hours. Huh. At times I saw that. But by and large, people weren't in character, quote unquote.
Wait, tell that story when you were – this was the Rome reenactment when you're
yes.
in Arkansas. And I think you're tying up your sandals or something like that. You're in outside of a tent and you hear two men inside, I guess it was. And they were in character. And it's kind of an amazing story in some ways.
Yeah. Well, this is the exception to the rule of what I just said.
Right.
Sometimes it does happen,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
I was inside the tent, and you have to imagine. Well, first of all, let me just set the scene, if you will. This is in a tiny town called Lafe, Arkansas, which has a population of about 385 people. And these two men over the past decade or so have been building this Roman compound in the backyard of this guy's house. And there's a 26,000 square foot fort there with watchtowers and moats. And so we're inside this. I'm inside it. And that's where all of our tents are. And there's barracks or whatever. And my sandal, you know, the lace or whatever kept breaking. And so I was in there and I was repairing it or whatever. And I hear outside in the courtyard, there's nobody else but these two guys in there. And I hear this one guy who's like a Roman legionnaire, and he goes up to like the centurion or whatever. And I hear him say something like, you know, I have killed the Celt and I am giving you his clothing. And I sort of look out, I sort of peer out of the tent and I see him holding, you know, sort of like plaid clothes. And he's like leaning, he's like kneeling down and he's like bowing down before this guy. And I'm like looking, I'm like, they don't know that I'm in here.
Yeah.
Like I'm not the audience at this time. And I'm like looking out, there's nobody around in the courtyard. And I'm like thinking, why are they doing this? It's just the two guys. They know each other outside of this as, you know, Dave and Rod or whatever their names were or whatever. And I thought, like, well, who's the – it was just very strange because you'd think in a situation like that they would want as large an audience as possible.
Yeah.
You know, that they were going to do this. But they were doing it for themselves. And maybe – I don't know. Maybe it was something that they had talked about. But they never knew that I was there. I was sort of peering out through the tent and I like closed the blind, you know, I closed the tent up and I was like, I'm just going to keep repairing my shoelace. But it was really bizarre. It was really strange.
Well, bizarre. And I think the thing that I thought about that story was that either this is really cool that they're doing that or it's really weird.
Yeah. I think it's both.
Yeah.
I think it's somewhere in between. I think that it's, you know, it's hard to... I think with hobbies, I think with things that people are really passionate about, I think it's really hard to gauge people's passion for it. I mean, if you see, like, we all have our little hobbies. I'm not really incredibly passionate about one hobby or whatever, but I think that, like, you never really know what's going on in people's minds, mm-hmm. like how... Like, this might just be the coolest thing on earth for him, you know?
Yeah.
For me, it's strange. But for him, it's like, I've always wondered what it's like to be a Roman legionnaire and to see, to walk into this place. And because when you walk into it, it's literally like you've kind of stepped back in time. I mean, there's nothing around that gives you any indication that you're not in Britannia in AD 43. I mean, it's very good. It's very well done. And so this is maybe his little fantasy coming out right now. He's never going to be an actor, but this is going to be his chance to sort of be an actor and to do it in a way that taps into this period of time that he really likes.
Of course, they stress authenticity. Most of them, certainly, no modern, eyeglass frames, and you have to wrap your food in most circumstances in, I think you say, tinfoil or waxed paper. I mean, they want to, for the Stalingrad, I mean, you got the $7 haircut, so you could kind of look like you were a German of that era.
Still get the $7 haircut,
by
the way.
Really, that got you started. Good for you.
Not in that style, I should say.
Well, but it's interesting because the question of kind of how it works. I mean, if you don't play along, there's this term, I think it's Farby.
Yes, Farb, which the derivation of that is from the Centennial Civil War celebrations, and it's far be it from me to criticize what you wear. The derivation of it. So, yeah, and for me, as somebody who's writing about all of this, and people would ask me, are you telling people that you're going to be writing about them? And I was like, of course, I'm not going undercover here.
Sure.
So, but they were really strict about, what I could write with. Or what I could write on, Rome, you would have, they're like a wax tablet or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But they were like, could you just wrap your notebook in brown leather, So, I had to like create this whole, device for my notebook. And, when I did the World War II reenactment, I had to have like a number two pencil and, write things down very, almost... I didn't want to break the illusion because I knew that this was an important part, and I also didn't want to be called out on it either. So the levels of authenticity, and I should say that this is not a firm rule for every reenactment. There are some reenactors who are quite Farby, and there are some reenactors who don't want to go and have this sort of extreme period rush experience. They would rather just, sleep in their camper and then... do the reenactment the next day. We're talking about a specific group of hardcore reenactors who want absolutely zero modern items that would infringe on their experience. But I should say also from my own experience, I put away all modern items as soon as I got to the site because I wanted to be as immersed in the world as possible.
So how does it work? I mean, I know... I'm sure this is different from all of them. You write about the experience of getting shot. I think this was still the Stalingrad one, or it may have been the Confederate one, where they give you this manila envelope, and you're not supposed to
open it.
Stalingrad. And you don't open it unless you get killed, basically.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And then it explains, basically, how you were killed. And I didn't, because I didn't know what I was doing. This was my first reenactment, and I didn't open it until the next day, where I had opened one, and it said, "Killed in action, choked on your own blood." And I was like, "Oh, a terrible way to die.
Yeah.
It's not very pleasant." But the rules of like how you die and what's expected. One of the things I learned very, very quickly. And I learned this at the Stalingrad reenactment, is that nobody plays by the rules. They had said, if you see like the flash of fire coming out of a barrel and it was sort of like whitish, that means it was pointed at you and you should die. And that's like the honor system. And so as soon as I saw that, I died.
Yeah.
And then I realized nobody else around me was dying. Like clearly some people are being shot around here, but nobody else is taking a dirt nap, as they say.
Yeah.
And so I realized that part of the fun for people in doing this is firing historical weapons, whether it's a World War II K-98 or whether it's a Enfield from the Civil War or a flintlock musket in the Revolutionary War or whatever. And that's part of the attraction of all of this, is being able to use and fire and experience what it's like to shoot a musket, which I have to say I'm kind of hooked on. I mean, muskets, I shouldn't say hooked on, but I found that to be incredibly fascinating, like firing an old musket,
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's take a call. Brock is with us in Willard, Utah. Brock, hi.
Hey, Doug. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
It sounds like the author has largely been working on battle reenactments and military sorts of reenactments. That seems to be a rather popular segment of the field, but not the entire field. And I'm wondering if he has done anything with other sorts of reenactments that maybe were not costumed or focused on civilian life within a battle scene, or other things that weren't necessarily military.
Absolutely. That's a great question. Yes. In fact, that's one of the things that I started to do as the book went on. I realized that even though I was jumping from World War II to the Civil War to Rome, that I was wearing different uniforms and I was using different weapons, but they were all starting to kind of, in some ways, look alike, yeah. You know, even though they were different settings. And so I tried to start focusing on more civilian stuff toward about the middle part of the book. And in fact, one of my favorite experiences actually is in chapter 7, where I spend a week rowing a replica bateau, which is a cargo boat, down the St. Lawrence River with a group from New York State. And I wanted to feel what that was like. What's the difference between military reenactment and civilian reenactment? And in fact, at the end of the book, I create my own reenactment, which is a civilian reenactment, because I thought it kind of gave me a chance to editorialize a little bit and say, well, if I was going to be a reenactor, because a lot of people ask me that question, what would I do?
Yeah.
What would I do? What would I create? Why would I create it in the way that I did? So, yes, I did delve into that, the Viking one that I did, the bateau. I walked around a Renaissance fair with a Polish winged hussar, which is a military character, a cavalryman from the 17th century Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, but there were no battles. So I tried to diversify, and I hope that at the end of the book I gave a well-rounded portrait of the hobby.
Brock, thanks. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join us. Let's see. Jill is with us in Salt Lake. Jill, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was curious if the author had considered what it was like to make believe as a child and how that sort of relates to what he's doing now. It was so simple for us as kids to sort of release this inhibition we had about pretending.
Yeah.
But now that he's an adult, everything has to be perfect in order for us to even get close to it. So I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
That's a great question.
That's a real, you know, I'm going to give you two examples very quickly. One is that when I did the row down the St. Lawrence River, I asked one of the guys why he's doing this. And he said, you know, when I was a kid, I used to challenge my friends to see who could run to the stop sign and make it there first. And he said, I don't do that anymore. And I loved that. I loved that inhibition that he had to go out on this adventure and to remain childlike in many ways by going on this sort of almost Huck Finn-like adventure that he went on. And I loved what he said about that, that, you know, you just didn't think about it. You just went out and played. And another guy, a Viking, said to me, you know, we have this stigma, and this was one of the things that you had asked earlier about, Doug, was that, you know, about, you know, the quirkiness of the hobby or the oddity of the hobby or whatever. And he said, you know, we have this thing in that if you dress up and if you want to be playful and if you're into all of this stuff, that somehow you're very strange. Whereas he saw it as this wonderful way of just expressing himself. It's like, we would never say that about a child. You know, we would never say that he or she was unusual because they liked to dress up and do this. But we have this stigma that's attached to people that like to do that who are adults. And I thought that was a really great response, that, hey, you know, we should just kind of chill out and just, you know, be able to play a little bit.
Yeah. Jill, thanks. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Charlie Schroeder is with us. His book is called Man of War, My Adventures in the World of Historical Reenactment. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Charlie Schroeder. We're talking about his book, Man of War, My Adventures in the World of Historical Reenactment. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. You write in the book about how you were – at first you were kind of worried that you might get bored by all of this. And you say, well, I'll read a history book one time and then I'll read a contemporary book so I won't get too bored. But then it seems like you were only about, I think, 6 months into it or something like that, and your interest and your knowledge is growing. But you were worried, you say, because you were becoming a little obsessed.
Yes. Well, yeah. I think I have kind of an obsessive personality. Yeah. I should get that off my chest. I need help. But I what I found about history that was so rewarding was that contemporary stories just haven't been able to, match up. They haven't been able to compete since, and I'm still completely obsessed with history. Mm. I like learning about the past because I think that in order for us to understand who we are, where we are, and why we're the way we are, we need to know what we were. It sounds very simple, but I think that not enough people probably study it, and I'm obviously guilty of that. I didn't for the first 37 years of my life. But I found that it was really kind of the perfect antidote to our times. We live in a very fast-paced, disposable culture where things are virtual and not real, and I felt like, and still do, feel as though history is the greatest foundation that any of us could learn. And if we all knew it, I think, a little bit more, perhaps we would make better decisions, not just about our own personal lives, but about the direction that our country goes in, and even our towns, and the way in which we care about the place where we live. That was one of the things that really stood out for me, is that the more you learn about the place where you live, the more you care about it, and the more that you want to make sure that place continues to thrive. And so you could look at history on many different levels. But I think, especially these days where everything seems to last, a mere flicker, that it's vital that we continue to talk about it.
I want to ask about the chapter you write about the Vietnam War reenactment experience. It seems like this was the most sobering.
Without question.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about a man named Patrick Hubble who had asked you at the end of this experience what you thought, and you were really candid. You were really honest with him, and you say, it was really rough.
Disturbing.
Disturbing. Exactly. Yeah. Talk about that if you would.
Well, yeah, I think I mentioned earlier about a lot of reenactors' opinions about the Vietnam War being reenacted, and a lot of people said, I should say that a lot of reenactors are middle-aged and they lived through the Vietnam War, and they said that it's a reality, not a history, and I think that it's one of those events that's still so raw. It didn't take long for me to talk to people out there for them to get very heated about it. It's unlike my generation, and I'm a Generation Xer, I don't know if we have that, and certainly that the baby boomers do. And what happened at that reenactment, I should say it was on private property, it was in Virginia, was quite disturbing.
Yeah.
I saw, prisoners being taken. There were, reenactors, white men dressed as Vietnamese villagers, speaking in imitation Vietnamese. I'm married to an Asian woman. It was all very strange, it was very peculiar. And there were some dangerous tactics that were used where people were roughing other people up and, screaming racial epithets and stuff like that. So, I wasn't quite sure what the point was.
Right.
If it gives you were there experience, why would you want to go back there? I guess that was my biggest question. I will say this, is that I think what Patrick Hubble, I think that what he does is actually quite respectful. He will go to events and he will display Vietnam War era uniforms and memorabilia. And a lot of Vietnam vets obviously didn't have a parade when they came home, and he's remembering them. And I think that a lot of people have showed their appreciation to him. And I still think we have that divide, in this country between those who were there, those who were drafted, or those who were here protesting. And I mean, I've even seen it out on my book tour talking about it. I remember I was in Gettysburg and a woman said, I spent my 18th birthday at Woodstock, and there was a guy right next to me, had a Vietnam vet hat, and he said, he's like, I spent my 18th birthday humping a, backpack in Saigon or whatever. And there was no love lost there either at this time. So it's just so close that I question, you know, why it would, somebody would want to relive it. For me, experiencing that was quite intense.
Yeah. Here's an email from Lewis who writes, I propose this phenomenon of war reenacting is possibly related to the fact that the U.S. has not been invaded or occupied by someone else's army within recent memory. My question is this. Do people in Europe and China and Russia, do they do this? I bet not, he writes. The reality of war is too close for people who remember their history.
That's a really great question. They do reenact it in Europe. It's quite popular in Europe. In fact, the American Civil War is probably the most popular war to reenact in England, believe it or not. What I found in my research globally is that typically countries that have not at one time been military powers do not reenact wars. So, for example, you'll see in Asia, the only evidence I could find of any war reenactment taking place in Asia was Japan,
right?
Which makes sense. And so it is mostly a Western phenomenon. But yes, typically military powers, and I think he's right. I think, you know, typically countries that have – not that they haven't been invaded, because certainly a lot of European countries have been, but that it's mostly if you had at one time been a military power, they tend to then reenact war.
Let's go back to the phones. Sean is with us in Salt Lake. Sean, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
I want to ask if you see a parallel between people who reenact the past and people who reenact the future. The example given, Star Trek aficionados.
Yeah.
Yeah, good question. Good question. I would say that one group in particular has more sci-fi leanings, and that would be the Vikings.
Huh.
They tend to, I don't know if, you know, I can't give you percentages or numbers, but they would be sort of, for lack of a better phrase, the Trekkies of the reenactment world. Mm. Because I think that the Dark Ages were so, and you can't even say the Dark Ages anymore, you have to say the early Middle Ages, you know, there's still this very mysterious place where we know very little about. And so there's this sort of fantasy element to it, you know, King Arthur and all this other stuff that happened at this time. So there is that attraction to it. Whether they actually dress up and, you know, reenact the future, I know there's LARPing, there's live action role play, and there's sci-fi conventions like Comic-Con or whatever. I can't say particularly whether they do that, but there is there's a correlation, I would say, between the two, because there are the sort of fantastical elements to both.
Mm. Sean, thanks very much. You know, you near the end of the adventure, you returned to the same Renaissance fair where you had worked, I think it was like 17 years before. And you yeah. write about how this was kind of like coming full circle. You know, you were the snarky kid before, and now you were someone who had been through all of this. And it's interesting, your reaction to it, because you were – it seems like you were really bugged that people weren't taking it as seriously as they needed to.
Seriously, as I was, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I mean, when I worked at the Renaissance Fair, you know, it was we weren't supposed to be out of, I think, what was it, 1587. We couldn't make any reference to any event that was post-1587. And in the interim, which is very hard, I should say, in the interim, the Renaissance Fair had started to actually kind of look like Comic-Con. And Renaissance Fairs, not that they're some, you know, authentic place of Elizabethan life, but it had gone far more toward the fantasy side, and there were all these people dressed up as, you know, Harajuku girls or like, you know, guys dressed in sci-fi costumes. And I kind of thought, well, you know, if you're going to be a place that's supposed to reflect the 16th century in England, then I think you should sort of stick to your guns. And I didn't like the fact that they were kind of just catering to the market now, you know.
Yeah.
I understand it's a business, but, you know, at the same time, people didn't have pink hair in 1587. not that I know of, at least.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah. I guess, what do you – I know there are all kinds of different answers to the question because there are so many different types of people who do this. But what do you think you understand now about why people do this, why they go into the world of historical reenactment?
Well, I mean, that's a great question, and it's a hard question to encapsulate. I think so many people are attracted to it for different reasons, different time periods, different regions of the country, what their own personal beliefs are now. What really what amazed me was just how broad it was, what the attraction was, why people did this. And so I walked away from it, not confused, but I couldn't put my finger on one specific thing.
Yeah.
People are attracted to it because of their heritage, because the United States doesn't have much of a history. People are attracted to it because of American history. People are attracted to it because of their local history. People like the war tactics. People like because it gives them a sense of power. It makes them feel good. People, there's so many reasons. So for me, it's a hard thing to encapsulate in one sentence because it's such a broad world. It's such a big country. It's such a big country. America is such an amazingly huge, diverse, crazy country, you know. And people are attracted to it for all these different reasons that I just couldn't say, well, that's a reenactor.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, I had to devote 277 pages right. to it.
Well, you know, the thing that I kept thinking is, and this is something you write toward the end of the book, is that how history shrinks the broad subject of history, this experience, to a personal scale. That seems to be the one thing. Is it kind of made it personal?
Yeah, absolutely. It says that there are all these big events that have happened in the world, but for a moment in time, you can slip on the shoes, you can slip on the uniform, you can try to eat the same food, and you can get a sense of what it was like just to have been a person. Just a person. Maybe not a general, maybe not a great leader, but just a person, just an average person who went through their daily lives. And you start to get an appreciation for what we have, all of the inventions that have happened since then, all of the things that have taken place, and maybe also have some perspective on we could have done some things a little bit better, too.
Charlie Schroeder. This book is called Man of War, My Adventures in the World of Historical Reenactment. Charlie, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you very much. That was a lot of fun.
Radio West, production of KUER News. Michael Havey directed the show today. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Andy Lane Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.